Rocco Baldelli may not have bred a Kentucky Derby winner, but then again, Colonel E.R. Bradley, John R. Madden, and John Galbraith never hit 60 home runs in the major leagues. Baldelli, now the first base coach for the Tampa Bay Rays, is busy breeding thoroughbreds when he's not on the ball field. Baldelli is our guest on this week's Thoroughbred Daily News podcast, brought to you by TaylorMade. And we'll be right back after this message from our sponsor, our good friends at TaylorMade.
And here it is! The 37-year wait is over! American Pharoah is finally the one! American Pharoah has won the Triple Crown!
Over the past four decades, TaylorMade has risen from a small boarding operation to the worldwide leader in thoroughbred sales and marketing. Here's Hall of Fame trainer Jerry Hollendorfer.
TaylorMade sales follow many horses that are training at the racetrack, and they are particularly adept at evaluating mares and placing them with a proper stallion after their racing careers are over. They are very straightforward and are also experts on confirmation of younger weanlings and yearlings.
My name is Tia Andrini, and I am from San Mateo, California. I've been doing business with TaylorMade for about a year now, and it's been one great experience after another. It started with my first TaylorMade venture when I bought an interest in the filly Catherine Sophia, which ultimately landed me 3 weeks later in the middle of the winner's circle of the 2016 Kentucky Oaks with her. The TaylorMade team is a group of truly outstanding individuals. They are knowledgeable, professional, and completely customer service driven. To me, the TaylorMade name epitomizes the term trusted advisor. That is exactly what they are, and I am very proud to be associated and doing business with them.
Discover what TaylorMade can do for you. Visit TaylorMadeFarm.com.
283 in the minor leagues. Shoots this one back into deep left field. That baby's gone. Rocco Baldelli has hit a pinch hit home run on a 2-1 pitch. And the Rays get two of those runs back. Rocco, in his first at bat since being activated, hits one out of here to left. And that will make it 8-7.
Well, Rocco Baldelli should have activated himself sooner. You get a hanging breaking ball right there, down in the count, or up in the count, 2-1. That ball, you see, ended up belt high, and he smashes it. Gets it out of here in a hurry, cuts into that lead. Welcome back, Rocco Baldelli. Awesome.
Well, Rocco Baldelli smashed many a baseball during his baseball career, but he never won a World Series during his 7 years in the major leagues. But will he breed a Kentucky Derby or Breeders' Cup Classic winner? You never know. On a small scale, but with some quality broodmares making up his operation, there's no telling what Baldelli could accomplish in racing. This is Bill Finley, and we're happy to have former major leaguer Rocco Baldelli as our guest on this week's TDN podcast. And welcome, Rocco, and let's start with the most obvious question to me. How does a guy who grows up in Woonsocket, Rhode Island, far removed from any racetrack that matters, get interested in thoroughbred horse racing?
Hi, Bill. You know, there's not really anything spectacular about my story. I've always, as a kid, I was not exposed to the horses very much. But I would always pick up my Sports Illustrated, or if there was, if any of the Triple Crown races were, you know, I could catch them on TV. I always was enamored with, I was enamored with the animals and the athleticism, and I found them beautiful. And as a young person, I kind of followed from afar. And when I retired from baseball, and I finally had some time to myself and able to enjoy things that I love, I jumped right in, and a man named Jerry Hunsicker, former general manager of the Houston Astros, very successful in baseball, became an advisor for the Tampa Bay Rays, where I worked and where I played. So he was and is still associated with the horses.
he's a big horse guy, and he introduced me basically to the world of horse racing.
Now, you mentioned Jerry Hunsinger, but during your time with the Tampa Bay Rays, one person in baseball who is most closely related with horse racing is Don Zimmer. And we've heard from other athletes and other people in racing just great humorous stories about, A, how much he loved the game and how much, frankly, he liked to bet. Was Zimmer an influence on you as well?
You know what? Zim was more of an influence on me as a person and on the baseball field. I knew that he loved the horses. I think everyone that spent time around him knew that he loved the track and loved the horses. I never truly picked his brain on his knowledge of horse racing, which is something I probably should have done, but I have a number of great memories, most of which were just sitting in the clubhouse with him, because he was such an amazing human being. On top of being the Don Zimmer that everyone knows on the field, he was just a good man, and we truly miss him. And he was very special to us in the Tampa Bay Rays organization. I still miss him to this day. We talk about him all the time.
I'm sure. And speaking of the crossover between baseball and horse racing, I know another person who was a mentor to you was a fellow by the name of Dan Dement, and he is partners with his brother Mike in Brigade's stable. Now, Dan never made the majors, but he played in the Tampa system, and I imagine that you must have been in the minors with him at some point along the line. So tell us that story. When and where did you meet him, and how has he been an influence with you so far as getting involved in racing and your second career as a horse racing breeder?
So the first person I ever met, first player I ever met in professional baseball, was a young guy named Dan Dement, still a friend of mine to this day. He's our double-A hitting coach with the Rays right now. So I met him on a puddle jumper flying into a place called Princeton, West Virginia in 2000, a couple of weeks after I graduated high school. I signed my contract. I was on a plane arriving in West Virginia. So I'm on the plane, and me and Dan became friends, very close friends. And like I said, still are to this day. And it just so happens that Dan's brother, Mike, was very into the horses, mm-hmm. and spends time up in Arlington, Chicago guys. And I'm actually partners with Mike on a broodmare as well to this day, and I still talk to those guys on the regular about the horses. Great people, and very much passionate about what's going on out on the track.
And Rocco, would it make sense that anyone who makes the major leagues probably has a better understanding of what goes into making a good athlete and perhaps a better eye for talent, be it four-legged or two-legged, than just the average Joe? And do you believe that to be true? And do you think that gives you any sort of advantage when you are looking at horses, you're looking at broodmares, when you're doing everything you need to do to be a successful breeder?
Well, I think there are a lot of similarities. I don't know if it actually helps me in any way, just due to the fact that I spend 99% of my time at a baseball field and not at the farms, where I'd like to be sometimes, but not at the farms and not at the auctions and out there learning. I do everything I can. I read as much as I can. I try to learn everything I can. But those instincts that I would have on the baseball field, or maybe even looking at a young baseball talent, young player, I think there are similarities, but I don't know if I'm able to use them yet, just due to my lack of mm-hmm. personal one-on-one experience with the animals. I do try to get to the auctions, and when I have time, I've spent as much time as I could learning from people who obviously know a lot more than I do. And I probably bother many of these guys with all the questions.
Right.
But that's kind of the way that I feel about it. I feel, though, that there are a lot of similarities, and that's probably maybe one reason why I'm so interested mm-hmm. in the animals. And I love going to the track, and I love watching the races, but I think the breeding aspect of it and the going to the farms and learning about the horses is as interesting or more to me than anything else.
Interesting. And Rocco, you've sort of mentioned already the next topic I wanted to talk about. When you take into account spring training, your baseball season from start to finish is, even if you don't make the playoffs, is at least a good 9 months. When you're working, you're probably working 12, 14-hour days. So when the baseball season is on, which is the majority of the year, how do you find time to immerse yourself in racing and immerse yourself into gaining knowledge that you need for the breeding business? I can't imagine it's easy.
No, I would say it's not easy. And like I said, most of my energy certainly goes into what I do on the baseball field. I do, when I have free time, when I'm on the plane, traveling, you know, at night, maybe when I get home, I am on the computer and I try to keep up with everything going on, and even reading basically anything on the internet or any books I can get my hands on, texting the people who I know in Kentucky in the horse industry, with just constant conversation. I do try to learn as much as I can, but during the baseball season, I think anyone who follows baseball knows it is a long year. And, you know, we're at the field relatively early. We're there late every day, and there are not very many days off over the course of those 9 months. So I'm perfectly happy with that. I love what I do. But the passion that I have for horse racing, sometimes it is tough to completely keep up as much as I would want.
I'm sure it is. Well, we'll take a look at Rocco Baldelli, the baseball player, when we return after this message from our sponsor, our good friends at TaylorMade.
TaylorMade, where customer success is our primary focus.
Ladies and gentlemen, we present Harvard of Grace.
7-10, you want to get 10 million, Hunter, right here, ready to get out of the mat. That's the way now, 10. 10-10, here, ready to get out of the mat, ready to get 10. Bruce, right here, $10 million even.
TaylorMade, where customer success is our primary focus. But don't take our word for it. Here's what some of our most satisfied customers have to say.
This is Brian Kahn, Los Angeles, California. I've been associated with, worked for, and been a client of TaylorMade and the TaylorMade family for close to 30 years now. Had great success with them. They've always been transparent and honest, and I always felt I was getting the right end of the deal with them. Highly recommend their services, from boarding, public sales, private sales. I've used all. All have been a success and a pleasure to deal with.
Here's longtime TaylorMade client Rick Porter of Fox Hill Farms, owner of numerous champions and Grade 1 winners, such as 2011 Horse of the Year, Havre de Grace.
I've been doing business with TaylorMade for over 20 years. Everyone knows they are the best sellers at auction, but they have also done great work for me in the private market. They have an unbelievable network that can help you buy or sell privately in a very professional and transparent way. I wish I had these guys working for me when I was in the car business.
Discover what TaylorMade can do for you. Visit TaylorMadeFarm.com.
Rocco Baldelli was a first-round draft pick, selected number 6 overall, took only 3 years to get to the majors, and drove in 78 runs in his rookie season. Rocco, conventional wisdom back then was that you were a future star. And you see a lot with young players, some of the things that we're going through here in New York City with some of the problems with the Mets. Did you believe that? Were you buying into the hype? Did you have that attitude that, boy, the world is my oyster, I'm going to take this game by storm?
Well, when I was a young player, that was probably one of the furthest things, you know, on my mind. I would say it was it wasn't that long ago, but it was definitely a simpler time. Mm-hmm. And I truly believe that. There's a lot of distraction these days that all of these players have to deal with, many of these distractions, which I did not have to worry about. I was worried about waking up, getting ready to go to the field, performing once I was there, enjoying myself and just giving it everything I have. And, you know, to this day, I don't have to, you know, worry or look at myself in the mirror in any way and say, you know, I wish I did things, in a different way. I'm happy with the way things happened in my career. I wish I could have played longer. But as far as the way anything was handled or by me, I was very happy with it. But I do kind of feel with, you know, for the players somewhat, and I do understand players are, you know, they're well compensated. It's a great life, and I'm sure none of them, very few of them, would trade what they have. But it is a very difficult and demanding, you know, situation that they're in. So, you know, and things are not always as they appear on the surface. And so, you know, passing judgment, which does happen sometimes, you know, I think it's better to weigh things out and give guys the benefit of the doubt. But when I was a young player, it does seem like things were a lot easier. You kind of just knew your role. You know, nodded, yes sir, no sir. You went out there and played, and you know, it was kind of you know, rank and file until you kind of get your time in the game. And I know things aren't quite like that anymore, and that's okay.
Right. Now, Rocco, few players have had more ups and downs in their major league careers than you have, and we're going to get into some of this, but let's start with the 2005 season. You tore your ACL. Later, you injured your elbow. You're not a pitcher. Still, you need Tommy John surgery. I believe you missed about a year and a half of your career at that point. How hard was that to sit on the sidelines for such an extended period of time?
It was not easy, and in sports, in horse racing, in athletics, we all know injuries are part of the game. But, you know, there's really no way to prepare yourself mentally, emotionally to deal with these things. So you're kind of just learning as you go. And in some ways, you kind of put your emotions, you know, to the side, and you kind of just become, I don't want to say some sort of machine. You wake up, you know what you have to do. You do your rehab, you do more rehab, you take care of yourself, you know, you get ready, you know, you go to bed and you wake up and you do the next thing, the next day. If you become overly, if you're analyzing everything, you let your mind wander too much, it does become really, really difficult. So that year and a half was a very difficult thing for me. I did have some experience with that, though, too. When I was 14 years old, when I was a freshman in high school, I actually had a very, very serious compound fracture, kind of a freak accident playing basketball, and I missed an extended period of time because of that as well. So it wasn't my first time dealing with, you know, dealing with something like that. So it wasn't probably as excruciating, you know, mentally as it could have been, but it was certainly not easy. And it's never easy when you take a big long break like that, and then you try to come back. Things are never the same after that.
I'm sure. But you came back with all cylinders burning in 2006, your first full year back after the injury. You batted .302, one of your best years ever. Did you feel like everything was back on track, and that, I know you probably don't take anything for granted, but, you know, I'm still young, I'm coming off a .300 season. You know, now you're going to see 10, 11, 12 really productive years from Rocco Baldelli in the major leagues?
You know what? I never really took the time to think about it like that. But if you asked me that question at the time, I probably would have been very happy with where my career was. And I was, it was a good year, and I couldn't have been happier with the way that I came back and played. So, and at that point, I really didn't have any reason to believe that it wouldn't go in a positive direction for a long period of time. I mean, I really didn't know what was to come. But as far as that season and even going into the next season, I was very, very pleased with the way I felt and the way I was playing. And I really had I really had no worries on my mind at that time, to be honest with you.
Right. Now, for the most part, 2006 was the last season that you were healthy, and I don't even, these big words all run together, but let me try to get through this.
Sure.
You were suffering from that afterwards, from what is called mitochondrial channelopathy, which is apparently a rare cell disorder that affects ions in the neurological pathways and causes severe muscle fatigue. You seemed at that point, Rocco, to be a perennial all-star, someone, again, as we've said, on your way to a terrific long-term career, and then this rare illness derails your career. First of all, tell us how that made you feel physically, and how did it make you feel mentally, having to deal with a tremendous setback in your baseball career?
Well, at that time, I was only 25 years old. It was going into my fifth year of playing in the big leagues. And like I said, I was at no point did I ever contemplate anything, you know, like this ever happening. So it was a very confusing time for me, just because you're thinking to yourself, there's no way that the feelings that I'm feeling in my body, there's no way that this stuff could be, this isn't real. This is a bad dream. You know, this is going to get better and I'm going to be fine. It didn't work out like that. And physically, just doing half of the workout or, you know, a quarter of the workout that I would normally do, all of a sudden I couldn't complete workouts. I was dealing with severe cramping for no apparent reason. I couldn't really make any sense of it constantly. You know, things that just were not on my radar, things just started to pop up out of nowhere. You know, if I would overwork myself, just jogging out to the outfield, if I ran too fast, or when I was on the bases one time, if I was sprinting, you know, going first to third, there was a chance I would tear a muscle or come in and my legs would kind of burn a little bit, like the way you would if you ran 5 miles or if you did a lot of squats or something like that. And it was happening for no reason. So, like I said, very confusing time for me. And there were periods of time where I didn't know if it would continue to get worse, because it came on out of nowhere. At least it felt like that. And then, so I'm worried that this is going to continue to get worse. How bad is this going to get? So I was a little scared, to say the least, and my baseball career basically went on the back burner because I was worried more about my health than I was about baseball.
Sure. Now, you did get back on the field, and people who know me personally or have listened to our Down the Stretch show on Sirius XM Radio know that I have a problem. I'm one of those need-to-get-a-life, diehard Boston Red Sox fans. So this is a little bit of a thrill for me, because in 2009, you did sign a one-year contract with the Red Sox. And growing up in Rhode Island, were you a Red Sox fan? And if so, was it a thrill to go to your hometown team?
Well, I would say I was a Red Sox fan, but probably not to the extent of most Red Sox fans. Okay. I grew up watching the Red Sox on NESN, you know, so they're always on the television. And, you know, I had some players that I really liked on the team. But as a young athlete, I always you know, had my home games going on. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't always be in front of the television. I'd be at the ball field playing or playing basketball or playing football. So. But I was a Red Sox fan. I grew up less than maybe, you know, 55 minutes from Fenway Park, right on the border of Massachusetts. So it was very nice for me to be able to go home, play in front of my family, play in front of my friends, show up to Fenway Park every day. You know, those guys, my teammates and the staff, they were very good to me. It was a special year for me, and something that was very nice. And especially coming after the year before, my last year in Tampa Bay, my last full year in Tampa Bay, and being able to go to the World Series, play in the playoffs, and then go to Boston the next year and experience that. I got to do a lot on the baseball field after I thought my career might be over. Mm-hmm. So I was very, very thankful for both of those things, because they were unexpected. I thought it was pretty much done at that point, and then I was given at least some sort of partial rebirth in the game, even if it were just playing part-time.
Right. Now, I'm going to ask you the question that all old Red Sox from that era get asked. We're going through the first of the post-Big Poppy era, the first time since 2002 that he has not been part of the team. And, you know, he just has become, as you well know, a larger-than-life figure. So from somebody who spent a full season around him as a teammate, you must have some stories. Just tell us, what was he like? Is he in the locker room everything that he seems to be out on the field and out in the public eye?
Well, first of all, he was a great teammate. That's the first thing I would say about him. He's a good person. He was a great teammate. And I would say that it's pretty amazing, because he's David. When he's in the clubhouse, he's David. And when the game starts, he's Big Poppy. And so, but it literally is a sort of transformation that he undergoes, because he's an easy guy to talk to. He's just a friendly human being and a great guy to be around. And then when the game starts, he's the guy. Like, he's, you know, he's almost like an action figure, and goes out there and does his thing on the field. And obviously one of the better hitters to play, you know, play the game in the last 20 years. And to do it at Fenway for Boston, and to come through in so many big moments for that team, he's never going to be forgotten up there. He's a very special, like I said, he's a very special guy, and a very special player that I don't think the fans should forget, ever.
I'm sure a lot of people in Boston listening to this will absolutely agree with you. Rocco returned to the Rays for the 2010 season after the 1 year with the Red Sox, but only lasted 10 games before retiring. And Rocco, if not for the injuries and all the things that we've gone through, particularly the injury that happened to you after the 2006 season, there's no telling what kind of career you would have had. You were really seemed to be on a path to, I don't know if you would have been a Hall of Famer, but you certainly were on the path to be a very important major league player for a long time. You would have made quite a bit of money. You were just getting ready to enter the period where free agency was booming. You're only 35 years old today. Who knows, you could still be playing. So summing all that up, was your career bittersweet or sweet, or a little bit of both?
Well, I would say that I love to be out there competing, and I didn't play with money or success or any of these things on my mind. I loved to play. So I miss being out on the field. And I think everyone that used to play any sport or do anything competitively that they enjoyed to do as a young person, you know, I think everyone misses being out there competing. You know, if you loved it once, you probably still love it. I'm very thankful for everything that I've ever been able to do. So I don't look at it as though, I don't look at it with disappointment. I don't think about it that way. I don't wake up every day and think to myself, you know, I can't believe that this happened. Because, you know, things like that don't happen to too many players. You know, people do, you know, have injuries and have, you know, things go on in their career that sometimes lead down roads you don't want to go down. But, you know, it's not really on the norm. So I know that, but I really got to experience some incredible things. And I tend to think about those things. I tend to think about all the things that I'm thankful for, and the fact that I got to play in the big leagues mm-hmm. for a while. I got to play in a World Series. I got to go home and play in front of my family and friends. I mean, yeah, I guess there could have been more and it could have gone on for longer, but I got to do more things than I ever could have imagined. So I tend to think about it with a smile on my face more than looking at it in any other way.
Now you've settled back into baseball in a new role as the coach with the Tampa Bay Rays, as we said earlier, the first base coach. You're learning from a very good manager in Kevin Cash, another former Red Sox, by the way.
Yes,
do
yes.
you have designs on becoming a manager someday?
That's not really on my radar. When I stopped playing, I went to work with the Rays, and I went to work in the front office, and they gave me a really nice role. And I would go out and evaluate players. I'd do the amateur draft. I would do the trade deadline. I would head to the Arizona Fall League. I would see all of our minor league teams, as well as our major league teams. I was very busy, and I was very lucky to be invited into the inner circle of what we did down here in Tampa. And then when Andrew Friedman, our GM and a good friend of mine, left, and Joe Maddon also left. And we were reassembling kind of what we were, the way we were set up in Tampa Bay. I was asked if I had any desire to put a uniform back on and coach. And I really had only thought about it very loosely before that point. But when it was posed to me, I really got serious about thinking about it. And I said, what the heck? I said, when else do you get the opportunity to just do this, especially going right to the major league level and start coaching? I had never coached anything in my life except maybe my little brother's basketball team at some point. So, you know, there's a little bit of apprehension there because I like to do things well, and I don't want to put myself in a position that I wasn't, you know, that I wasn't ready to perform in. But I said, I'm going to do this. I'm going to dive in head first and give it everything I have. And I started coaching 3 years ago, and I love it.
Very good. Well, we'll turn back to horse racing and Rocco Baldelli's breeding operation after this message from our sponsor, TaylorMade.
M. Shawish has taken the lead as they come into the final 16th.
The main reason we ended up trying M. Shawish on the dirt is he was just so impressive in the mornings to watch train on the dirt. And, you know, he continually worked exceptionally well, showed us that, you know, he was able not only to finish his work strongly, but then gallop out brilliantly. And you know, we just felt like he had a dirt pedigree as well, being a Medaglia d'Oro out of a Thunder Gulch mare, that it, you know, wouldn't be a surprise if he ran well in the dirt. And certainly he did.
And it is M. Shawish, the winner of the Don Handicap.
Rocco, the first broodmare you bought was named Union Waters, and you paid $140,000 for her at the 2011 Keeneland November sale. So right away, you sort of made a statement. You're not a guy shopping in the bargain basement bin. You're not looking for $10,000 mares. So what is your philosophy when it comes to trying to breed a good racehorse? Obviously, quality is something that's important to you.
When I first jumped into this, again, Jerry Hunsinger helped me out a lot. David and Gordo went to the sales, and we were working together, and David went, and I wanted to buy something out of the Ned Evans dispersal. I thought it would be a nice place to start, and you know, obviously Mr. Evans had a lot of quality in his band. So we went in, and my goal was just to buy a nice, and David is obviously very good and knows what he likes and what he doesn't. Find a nice mare in sort of that price range that I could breed and be able to bring the foals to auction, and enough quality in the mare that you could breed the mare to, you know, maybe not the highest end, the absolute highest end stallions, but quality stallions, you know, able to get some foals that could bring some nice prices. So that was really my goal, and my goal is really to breed a nice racehorse as well as something that I can take to the sales. That's kind of my overarching goals.
Okay. Now, how many broodmares do you have now, and whatever that number is, are you looking to build, or is this pretty much, if you have 3-4, which is my guess, is that pretty much your comfort level right now?
That is my comfort level, and you kind of nailed it. I have two broodmares that are just mine. I have another broodmare that I have with Mr. Dement, who we talked about earlier,
mm-hmm.
and Braxton Lynch as well. And we have a nice smart strike mare named No Split that we breed together. And then I have two fillies on the track right now as well. And generally, I probably wouldn't race colts at all. So the fillies that I would go out and get generally would have nice pages, and you know, hoping to get some black type on there, and then bring them to the shed afterwards and breed them. So that's basically my goal and what I'm trying to do. It's all revolving around bringing them back to the breeding shed.
From a financial standpoint, your biggest success to date as a breeder has been a horse who's now a 2-year-old by the name of Smash Williams. And I don't know if you came up with the name, probably not, but that was a character in a terrific show, Friday Night Lights, that you sold for $220,000. Was that a good feeling? And again, you know, you said in baseball money wasn't a huge deal to you, but that's a nice number. Did it make you feel like you had arrived as a breeder and you had started to figure this thing out?
Well, I certainly don't think I figured anything out, to be honest with you, but that more than ready, well, actually that mare in general proved some very, very nice looking foals. And the first foal, it's funny, the first foal she threw was a Stormy Atlantic, and I bought her a foal to Stormy Atlantic. And that foal did not quite look the part, was a little big. But after that, I bred her to Spikestown when Spikestown was kind of up and coming. And we sold that foal, that colt, for a nice sum. And that was a really good feeling. And it's really helpful as a young breeder. You know, for a while, you know, there's usually not a lot of checks coming in, but there's a lot of checks going out. And that was something that I had to get used to, you know, in this industry. But to have that sale go down, that Spikestown colt was very nice. And that Spikestown colt, I believe, was bought by Judmont
okay.
the same year that they also bought Arrogate at the sale when they decided to dive in and send some horses out to the West mm-hmm. Coast. So that was pretty cool on my end when I saw that coming. Then I put her in full to More Than Ready, and then we sold her at the auction in full to More Than Ready.
Okay. Now, the bad news on the Smash Williams stories is that the horse was sold to a pinhooker who turned around and sold the horse for $460,000 to Let's Go Stable in Stone Street, and he's now yeah. with Todd Pletcher working in Florida. We don't know what kind of horse he's going to turn out to be, but do you regret selling him when you did and the timing of it, or have you just learned that's all just part of the game?
I think it's completely just part of this game, and I honestly root for everybody. So any decision that I would make, I make with the help of people. I have people who I would consult with and are very, very helpful to me. And when I ask questions, you know, I get answers, and then at the end of the day, I'll make a decision. And I live with those decisions just fine. So any of the foals that I would sell as weanlings, when they're pinhooked and they're brought around and sold for more money, there's a small part of you that's, you know, obviously thinks, I wish I was the one selling this horse right now, but I am very comfortable and thinking, you know, good for them that they made a nice decision and were able to make some money. I'm perfectly okay with it. I sleep well at night.
I bet you do. And Rocco, the when you have these mares, and again, you've said that, you know, while you may not send them to Tappet, you're also not sending them to $10,000 regional sires. So you're obviously trying to pick your spots. How do you go about selecting your matings? How much is your own knowledge? How much do you rely on others? What's sort of your MO when it comes to doing that?
Well, I spend a lot of time researching the pedigrees of the horses and the mares that I have. I get about as in-depth as I possibly can. So I pay attention, obviously, to, just the quality of the stallions and trying to fit that with the, whatever mare I'm breeding to at that point. Obviously, the physical plays a pretty good-sized part. And I do look at some of the pedigrees and the way that they would work. I guess some people would call them nicking and things mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. I think that's one part of it. And I think if you pay too much attention to any one part of it, you might miss something on the other end. So I think it's just combining all of that. That's the way that I do it. And I also know that the people that I consult with, I know that they're a lot more knowledgeable than me. So I put some stock into what they say, too.
Now by two from Star Super and Lucky in Malibu to third. Squan's Kingdom advances fourth on the far outside as they pass the quarter pole and straighten on for home. Unicoi's the leader, but Star Super's got momentum, and now to the lead is Star Super. Star Super, Lucky in Malibu, Squan's Kingdom on the outside is racing third position, seems to have flattened a bit. Here comes Lucky in Malibu, Star Super, Lucky in Malibu, Star Super sees rival Lucky in Malibu, Star Super, McCarthy got it. It is McCarthy with the stakes. Double Star Super, Lucky in Malibu, Squan's Kingdom, and I Am, I Will, and I Am Thee.
January 21 of this year at Laurel, Star Super wins the Marshua Stakes. Rocco Baldelli is the co-breeder with partners Caldera Farm and Lanes and Bloodstock. And again, you know, you talk about pivotal moments or moments in your career as a breeder that you're probably always going to remember. I would think this is right up there. You now have bred a stakes winner. A little bit of a proud papa moment?
Yeah, actually, kind of. I was very excited to see that, and I co-bred the horse with Callan Strauss, who runs Lanes End Oak Tree Division, mm-hmm. where I keep some of my mares, and he's a good friend of mine and a great man. Him and David and Gordo and Lanes End, and it was very cool to do it with them, and doing it as a group. We kind of get to enjoy it together. And I think you're right. I don't think you'll ever forget it. If you're into this business, I don't think you'll ever forget the first stakes winner that you bred. And you have these hopes and dreams for each one of them, regardless if you breed one that looks like a superstar or you breed one that maybe doesn't quite look like a superstar. You know, you always think what if, and that's the way it turned out for us. You know, we didn't know that this would be the filly that would do it out of all of them. You know, I maybe wouldn't have guessed it at one point, but that's what makes the game really fun.
And Rocco, as you mentioned earlier, for the most part, you're not really involved in the ownership aspect of it. You said you've dabbled it in a little bit. Do you ever see that changing? Would you ever like to have a stable of 5-6 of your own horses?
Oh, I'd love to. I don't know if I will ever be able to get to that point. But at this point, I actually do have a filly named LaMonta Grease, who's on the track now. She's actually entered at Churchill for this Saturday. Mm-hmm. Rusty Arnold has her. She's for the most part, I think, going to be a grass filly, and she has some ability. So I'm very excited and really interested in watching what she does over the next year or two. She's from a very nice family, family of Honey Rider, and very later developing grass family. So we're going to give her time and some distance and see what she can do. But it should be fun. And then I have a filly named Cyphering Sue, who I have with Callan Strauss again. We teamed up and are sending her out. She's a 2-year-old, so again, we'll give her a little bit of time as well. But so I do have two fillies out there now, which is probably as many as I can foresee myself having at one time. I don't need to have a ton of horses to enjoy it, and I'm very happy just having a couple. It's a lot of fun.
Right. And Rocco, through this conversation, I've learned something about you. There's an expression, a baseball lifer, and your enthusiasm for the game of baseball comes through. So I'm guessing that you're not looking to get out of baseball in any way, shape, or form. But could there ever become a day where maybe you would think about, well, I want new challenges in my life. I want to do something different. And do you ever see yourself getting less involved with baseball and becoming, you know, more of a high roller breeder, whereas you don't have 3 or 4 brood mares, but maybe you have 25. Is that something that you even, you know, dream about, or is that just not practical for you right now?
Well, being 35 years old and being in a spot where I work in a great place with good people who I love, and they treat me very well here in Tampa Bay. I don't foresee myself getting out of baseball anytime soon because I like what I do. Mm-hmm. And I love showing up to the baseball field still. And when the day comes, if it ever comes, where I don't feel like that, I promise I will not show up to the baseball field anymore. But as of now, I don't see it. I think anyone in the thoroughbred game does always dream of doing bigger and better things. I would love to have a band of mares and send them to Warfront and the Tappets of the world and be able to do that. As of now, it probably doesn't fit with what I'm able to do, but you know, you never say never, and you know, you can always dream, right?
Gotcha. Now, Rocco, I'm sure like most good athletes or anybody when they were 12 years old, I'm sure you had dreams of hitting a walk-off home run in the 7th game of the World Series for the Red Sox or whomever. Now that you're no longer playing, we know that's not going to happen, though, again, you had a terrific career. Have those dreams now turned to, I'm going to breed a Kentucky Derby winner or a Breeders' Cup Classic winner, just like I said in our introduction. Is that something that, you know, is now the new dream for Rocco Baldelli?
I would say my dream is to win a World Series on the baseball field.
Okay.
I would say that is definitely, that's been my goal since I signed my contract, my first contract out of high school. It's been the focus of all of my energy. Or the vast majority of my thoughts and my energy has been that, and I'm still working towards that. And that's probably the ultimate thing that I will always shoot for. The thoroughbred industry has kind of entered into my life a little bit later than baseball, but that would also be another dream of mine. And I think more than anything else, you know, I love the Triple Crown races. I love following them. I love following the the colts that are in the races, you know, due to looking at potential sires that you can breed to someday. And that's kind of how I look at a lot of these races. You know, I start delving into the pedigrees and who would fit with the mares that I have, and hoping that certain stallions, you know, certain runners win so they can become stallions. I would love to maybe one day own, you know, my dream is more to own a filly that maybe runs in some of the bigger races and to, you know, win a distaff or something like that. And it doesn't sound like what most people would say, but that's kind of something that's more on my mind than ever owning, you know, a colt that runs right. the Kentucky Derby or something like that. That's kind of where my dream would be to do something like that, and then to have a beautiful mare to breed for the next 15 years. And see where that takes me.
So you win the Breeders' Cup Distaff, breed the horse to the top stallion in the country, and sell it for $2 million at the sales. How does that sound?
Now you're talking.
Okay, very good. Rocco, yeah. You've been absolutely terrific. I know you're very busy, particularly this time of year with baseball. Best of luck to you, the Tampa Bay Rays. Best of luck with your breeding operation, the few racehorses you own. We've had a great time chatting with you. And once again, good luck getting to the winner's circle. Good luck getting to victory in the World Series. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Bill.